I think this is a major victory, one that I never would have predicted. I'm usually much more cynical about how this stuff is going to go down.
The FCC ruled in favor of net neutrality. It only took a decade, but who's counting? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. In more Digi news, AT&T is offering a high-speed internet service that offers not to spy on you for a price.
I kind of look at it as an extortion. It's like ransoming your privacy for like $540-something dollars a year at a minimum.
Also, we revisit a moment when Libyans, voting for the first time, were full of hope for their future.
So I see my mom coming out of the area right now. She's waving her ink-stained finger. How was it?
I felt I did something right for my first time in this place here.
There's more coming up. Stay tuned. Since you're listening to this show, I'm guessing you may be wondering about what happens to your privacy, your rights, and even your behavior when you go online. If you do, you might want to check out WNYC's New Tech City. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the WNYC app. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Thursday, the FCC voted 2-3 along party lines in favor of net neutrality, reclassifying broadband internet as a telecom service like phone lines. The Open Internet Order delivered this week also bans internet service providers from giving faster connections to websites that pay for the privilege or slowing connections to websites that don't. Here's Tom Wheeler, chair of the FCC.
This proposal has been described by one opponent as, quote, a secret plan to regulate the internet. Nonsense. This is no more a plan to regulate the internet than the First Amendment is a plan to regulate free speech. They both stand for the same concept. Openness, expression, and an absence of gatekeepers telling people what they can do, where they can go, and what they can think.
Wheeler took note of the unprecedented 4 million citizens who took their time to send comments to the FCC, overwhelmingly in favor of net neutrality. That was a triumph in and of itself for a drawn-out tech policy debate. Siva Vaidyanathan, a media studies professor at the University of Virginia, is cheering too.
After years of wrangling and debate and hemming and hawing, the Federal Communication Commission finally decided to reclassify broadband, first of all, as being fairly fast, basically the speed that lets you watch YouTube videos. And that matters in terms of determining how much competition there is out there. If you classify broadband as being very slow, like DSL, then you can imagine that a lot of Americans have choices when they really don't. It makes sure that it's very clear to Congress, very clear to everyone who matters, that for most Americans, there really is no competition and no choice in broadband providers. If we had real competition, we wouldn't need regulations like this necessarily, because the company that cheated would get punished in the market. That's the theory anyway. But the most important reclassification is reclassifying broadband internet, high-speed internet, like a common carrier, like the phone company. Phone companies don't favor one producer of voice signals over another. What we really needed was for the data flowing out of our walls to be treated the same way. So I think this is a major victory, one that I never would have predicted. I'm usually much more cynical about how this stuff is going to go down.
On the other hand, not to give your cynicism short shrift, you mentioned, as many others have, that this is just the first step. This will inevitably end up in the courts, where it'll be battled all over again. Are those people just raining on the parade?
When a federal appeals court struck down the previous attempt at network neutrality rules, the court made it pretty clear that if the FCC decided to reclassify broadband under Title II, everything would be cool. So there will be legal challenges, but most of those legal challenges will be about the details of the execution of the regulation, but not necessarily about the heart of it, the heart of it being reclassification. More likely, we're going to see Congress make another run at curbing the influence of the FCC, because that's where the lobbyists really work. The lobbyists don't have any influence over the court system. And this time, Congress wasn't in a position to make a stand, largely because of the public uproar in favor of network neutrality. But they'll just wait for a quieter time and they'll chip away at it.
The last time I spoke to you, it was January of last year, after what many decried as a death blow to net neutrality. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals had struck down the FCC rules. When we spoke, you basically said that it was pretty much irrelevant. Why don't we replay that?
I look at the real decision makers in our information ecosystem, and I see four big companies today. I see Apple, I see Microsoft, I see Facebook, and I see Google. And I say, what do those companies want? They aren't necessarily in the business of mastering and monitoring and monetizing what comes over your desktop computer or even your mobile phone. They want to run the operating systems of your life. They see a time in the not too distant future where so many different articles in our lives will have data flow through them, and they want to be able to monitor and monetize that data flow.
So, do you still think, now that this vote has passed, that the time has passed for the issue of net neutrality?
What's really significant about this week's decision to codify network neutrality is that for the first time, it explicitly covers wireless. So that buys us more time and makes this network neutrality provision a lot more relevant for the next 5 or 6 years. But what's depressing to me about the network neutrality drama up to this point is that it took so long to even rise to the point that we had an informed, intelligent debate about it in this country. Once we got there, it became really clear to everybody that we really needed to do this. If you weren't cashing checks from Comcast, it made sense to support network neutrality. And that's fortunately where we are today. But we should get beyond network neutrality. We should get beyond the desktop, even beyond the mobile phone, and think very critically about the sorts of technological challenges we have in the next 5, 10, 20 years. They're going to dwarf the debates of the past.
What are the other issues that you so ominously refer to that require further regulation?
Look, increasingly, through our mobile devices, through wearable technology, and soon through our automobiles, we are going to face a concentration of power as one or two companies rise to control the flow of data through our lives. The reason that network neutrality doesn't matter to any of that ultimately is that this new data network that we misname the Internet of Things is not at all like the Internet, and it will have to be highly secure. It will have to be controlled by one or maybe two companies, and it's going to involve all sorts of challenges as we find human bodies being tracked and monitored and perhaps that data being exploited or leaked.
You know, right now we have the technology that can go into your car and make it crash while you're in it, and you have no control over it. That exists right now. What essentially will be at the heart of the next debate over the data that flows over the Internet?
What we're going to see in the next few years is the control over our bodies as we surrender and outsource decision-making to algorithms, data sets. We are going to come up with conflicts and challenges that we can't even articulate yet. But I can definitely say that the sense of, for instance, ownership over the data we produce, a sense of how open this data will be to state intervention or state examination. We're going to have all sorts of questions over the values that are embedded in these algorithms that are going to make these decisions and figure out whether we're going to have, you know, more orange juice in our fridge because our fridges are telling us we're out of orange juice. Well, maybe our fridges can tell us what kind of orange juice or what brand of orange juice. Maybe there's a contract involved in that. That's going to affect advertising. It's going to affect consumer choices. It's going to affect nutrition. There are going to be all sorts of questions of control that come out of these data flows. As you said, we're on the precipice of facing these. We already have these technologies in our lives. They're not widely distributed. And my fear is that from a regulatory point of view, we're not mature enough to handle this yet.
Well, thanks.
Anytime, Britt.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor in the Media Studies Department at the University of Virginia and the author of The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. It's central to our lives for information and entertainment and the primary source of shared culture. Its distribution is in the hands of a few corporate leviathans. It serves the public interest, except when it doesn't. Its vaunted role as a tool of democracy is constantly being usurped by the naked exigencies of commerce. I speak, of course, of radio. 70 years ago. In light of the FCC's ruling on the future of the internet, last week Bob took a little trip back to the future with Victor Pickard, who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. In his book, America's Battle for Media Democracy, he traces an eerily familiar policy debate taken up by a much earlier incarnation of the FCC.
You had just NBC and CBS. There was also a smaller network mutual broadcasting system. But in many ways, you were dealing with radio duopolies and monopolies. And it was manifesting in not just nonstop soap operas, some racist programming like Amos and Andy. You had a purge of liberal commentators throughout the 40s. And so people were concerned that the most popular medium of the time, radio, was not living up to its democratic potential.
Who was fighting this fight, and how did they go about fighting it?
At this time, you saw a spike in activism around the labor movement, the civil rights movement. There was also a feisty consumer rights movement. And they found that their messages were not getting into the media. There were letter-writing campaigns, petitions, some coordination with natural allies at the FCC. There was kind of pressure from above and below that advanced this media reform coalition in a number of inconceivable policy interventions for us to consider today.
There was one commissioner who spoke out about the triviality of the programming in what we would hear again 20 years later by Newton Minow in his famous assault on the, quote, vast wasteland of TV. Who was that?
James Lawrence Fly, better known as Larry Fly, certainly not a household name today, but in the 1940s, he struck fear in the hearts of commercial broadcasters. He was known as an anti-monopolist crusader. He'd cut his teeth during various political battles in FDR's New Deal government in the 1930s. And when he arrived at the FCC, he set out to take on radio monopolies, and that's exactly what he did.
That's the Twilight Zone thing for me. A New Deal activist big government that found favor with the public, and OMG, Southern liberals on the FCC at the time.
We have a very different FCC in action today, but at the time in the late 30s and throughout the 40s, even when the New Deal agenda was in various stages of retreat, it arrived later and stayed longer at the FCC. In fact, the FCC was kind of the New Deal's last stand.
And as a result of the agitation, what happened?
Larry Fly initiated this very aggressive study on the lack of competition in radio markets as well as other problems. And the findings of this study led to a number of rules that forced NBC to divest itself of one of its major networks. This is actually how we got ABC. And this is pretty inconceivable for us today. It would be like Tom Wheeler forcing Comcast to break itself up. It's a form of trust busting almost. This was the first initiative. Then we had what was known as the FCC Blue Book to create license renewals contingent on very meaningful public interest obligations.
Yeah, I remember when to get access to the public airwaves, broadcasters had to demonstrate some sort of public-mindedness.
It's a quaint idea.
It's so quaint.
In fact, Larry Fly was fond of saying that the air belongs to the public, so therefore radio should be in the public interest. and it was treated as a almost communistic attempt by big government to take over the airwaves from the commercial broadcasters. And that's what really led to the diminished expectations of these initiatives. They were largely stymied by red baiting throughout the decade. We ended with the Fairness Doctrine, which is probably something that many of your listeners have at least heard of.
Yeah, it's gone now, but for decades, it did prescribe various public-spirited measures by broadcasters. What were they?
And the two parts of the Fairness Doctrine, the first part's often forgotten, which is that broadcasters should cover significant issues that are important to local communities, and then to do so in a balanced manner. Many people conflate it with the equal time rule. But today, in many ways, it lives on. Anytime you hear of something mildly proactive by the FCC, certain constituencies, especially conservative activists, will call that a stealth or backdoor fairness doctrine. They've even likened the net neutrality protections as a fairness doctrine for the internet, which, of course, is not true at all.
The political environment has changed quite a bit in the last 70 years, but in this case, citizen activists have seemed to have quite an effect on Tom Wheeler. In what ways does the past predict the current situation?
Well, I think it really stands as testament for the power of public engagement around these media policies. As you noted, the shift in this debate has been quite dramatic over the last 6 months, and I think much of that can be attributed to the nearly 4 million people who wrote into the FCC in response to their open internet proposals. But I also think it shows that there needs to be sustained public engagement. We ignore media policy at our own peril. And how this debate plays out may determine whether we follow the path of broadcasting or begin to create a media system worthy of its democratic promise.
Victor, many thanks.
Thanks for having me on the show, Bob.
Victor Picard is an assistant professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book on this topic is titled America's Battle for Media Democracy.
Coming up, AT&T offers a super fast internet connection, but wants us to pay for our privacy. Would you take the deal? This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If you're looking for a new podcast to try out, may we suggest WNYC's New Tech City? Host Manoush Zomorodi asks questions about tech that you might not even know you care about until you hear them. Like, what is all this reading on a screen doing to my brain? Or why do I get twitchy when my phone's out of reach? It's a podcast that aims to bring a little balance to what may be an intrusively digital life. You can find New Tech City wherever you get your podcasts, including, of course, on the WNYC app. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week in Kansas City, when AT&T rolled out its new high-speed internet network dubbed Gigapower, it made a lot of news. Most of it bad.
AT&T for $29 a month will keep your data private.
That's right. AT&T wants you to pay extra for your own privacy. The telecom's new super fast broadband will charge customers $29 a month more to keep their online searches secret.
AT&T wants users to pay more for privacy.
Indeed, if you sign up for AT&T's Gigapower network, which boasts speeds up to 100 times that of the average provider, you're also giving your consent for AT&T's Internet Preferences program, which will collect your data, track your activity, and target advertising to you. If you'd rather not be tracked, you can opt out for the aforementioned extra $29 a month. At least that's the story according to AT&T and the media. But actually, there's a lot more to that story, according to Stacey Higginbotham, a writer for the tech site GigaOM, including the price that AT&T has set for its right to privacy.
It's not $29. It's actually $44 a month or $66, depending on which plan you choose.
So the media have been parroting AT&T's price without really checking it?
Yes, they have, although I don't blame them because it's actually really hard to fact-check AT&T in this situation. You would have to have an address in one of the two cities that AT&T is actually offering the Gigapower service. That's Austin or Kansas City. I actually live in Austin, but I can't actually use my own address because I don't live on a street where AT&T offers the service. So I had to call a friend who has Gigapower service and then look up an address near hers and use that address. So it makes it very difficult to even fact-check AT&T in this situation.
So what exactly do you get if you pay the privacy fee and opt out? Are you then able to use the internet without any fear of data mining or targeted ads, at least from AT&T? Because I know they have no control over Google or Amazon or Facebook or any of those others.
Not exactly. AT&T is still going to use your information that they get from you as a subscriber to market to you and try to get you to subscribe to other AT&T services. What you'll basically get is AT&T isn't going to monitor your web surfing and try to serve you ads based on your web surfing history.
Now, getting a discount in exchange for getting targeted ads is not new. I mean, Amazon offers a discount on their Kindle tablets if you allow them to show you ads. But this is different, right? Because it isn't a tablet or a streaming service, but access to the internet itself. Have we ever seen anything like this from an internet service provider where you don't get a discount for allowing them to target ads, but you can pay them not to target ads to you?
We haven't so far, and I really think this crosses a line. If you agree that internet service is a fundamental human right, AT&T is not in a competitive market.
AT&T's Gigapower network is offered in some of the same cities as Google's fiber network, which provides the same high speeds without the privacy fee. Won't people just switch to Google if they don't want to pay for privacy?
They will say that they're competing with Google. But we don't actually have proof, because we don't collect this data, that AT&T competes head-to-head with Google at the street level, at the address and house level, for gigabit service. So it's not like I have a choice between giving up my privacy to AT&T or choosing Google, which doesn't ask me to give up my privacy.
But don't you automatically give up your privacy when you use the Google service?
Well, see, that's the comparison that AT&T will try to get you to make. But it's fundamentally different because Google does not inspect the bits as they flow over the internet from your house to other servers. Google doesn't spy on you in the same way that AT&T is offering to spy on you.
It isn't really offering. It will spy on you unless you pay to get them to stop. So rather than it being our right to privacy that they're asking to bypass, they're framing it as their right to follow us that we can buy back.
Right. I kind of look at it as an extortion. It's like ransoming your privacy for like $540-something dollars a year at a minimum. But I don't think that AT&T should get away with doing this unless it's a truly competitive market and people have the option of another super fast broadband provider that doesn't offer this plan.
It is ridiculously fast, right? 100 times the average broadband speed. I mean, average consumers could make a choice just to do without that much speed.
And many do. But I was at CES and they were showing off 4K televisions. And the minimum broadband speeds you need for 4K are 25 megabits per second. So if you look at a household that has two or three 4K TVs and people are watching all those televisions, you suddenly are looking at a household that needs about 100 megabits per second connection, right?
So if not today, then tomorrow.
Very soon.
Now, not everyone is upset about this policy. Your colleague, Jeff John Roberts, wrote an article applauding AT&T for being, at the very least, transparent and giving us a say in the matter. Other ISPs have the capacity to follow us in the same way. Isn't AT&T giving consumers a choice? Aren't they being out front about what they are doing?
When you actually go to sign up for the service, you have to search to avoid this plan. At the bottom, it is a tiny little footnote. Click here if you would like to learn more about plans without the Internet Preferences plan. AT&T says very few people are taking them up on the privacy option. Really, how many people are going to spend $44 or even $66 extra a month on something as nebulous as privacy?
Getting back to your colleague, he wrote that while the choice between money and privacy appears stark, the internet has always worked this way.
But not at the ISP level. The fundamental distinction that we need to make is ISPs are a pipe that transmits these bits. And services like Facebook and Google, before they became an ISP, they're web services, they're apps, and you can switch from them. They run on top of that pipe. And while it might be horrible to switch from Facebook and you'd miss all your friends, there are other social networks. There's Twitter, there's things like that. But you can't switch from your ISP. There's limited competition in this market, and this is access to the internet. This is a basic right. So for them to be able to try to sell you access to your privacy, it's a different game, and it's not one that we should be playing.
Do you think this could set a precedent that other service providers like Google could follow, just like with the airlines? Once you didn't have to pay for dinner, now you do. I mean, if they see that people are willing to pay.
If the FCC votes to implement Title II and implement real net neutrality, then they have the option of stopping what AT&T is doing, because Section 222 says that ISPs can't track people's private information.
It always seems that when it comes down to a choice between privacy and convenience, Americans will choose convenience.
I think that's true. I mean, there's plenty of studies showing that people will give you their social security number for a cookie.
What study is that?
I will send you a link because it exists.
Stacey, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Stacey Higginbotham is a writer for the tech site GigaOhm and host of the Internet of Things podcast. AT&T responded with this statement, quote, "We offer our customers some of the fastest internet speeds available and do so in a way that ensures they have a clear choice. Our pricing is clearly explained on our website. Under the current promotional offer, we're providing additional benefits and waiving certain costs, which is a common practice when providers launch new services. Since we began offering our tailored ad program more than a year ago, the vast majority have elected to opt in," unquote. By the way, what AT&T here is calling its tailored ad program is the tracking program, the cheaper internet preferences plan that we've been discussing. Coming up, a look back to a happy day in the Arab Spring. This is On the Media.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, it's Meredith from TLDR. This week, two men on a mission.
Charlie and I were sitting in our office one morning, drinking coffee, eating oatmeal, and we were just talking about it, and it's like, I wish we could tell people. I wish we could make people realize we're a real-life couple.
If you like the show, check out our other episodes and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The situation in Libya continues to deteriorate as two rival governments battle for control, creating a vacuum into which Islamic State militants have surged. Hundreds of thousands of people have already fled the violence, many of them dying on the way. Back in August of 2012, the picture was very different. It was the first anniversary of the toppling of Muammar Gaddafi's 42-year rule. When the uprising first began, in February of 2011, OTM producer Sara Abdurrahman took a holiday from journalism to work with a Twitter feed called @Feb17Voices, created to keep information flowing out of Libya in case of a media blackout. Sarah's leaving On the Media to be with her newborn son, but during her time here, she produced, among many, many things, our trip to Mexico and to Egypt, and also our award-winning examination of transparency at the border. As our tribute to Sarah, here's the piece she made when she visited Libya for the first time 1 year after the revolution to witness its election and to meet the people behind the voices of Feb 17.
The Feb 17 Voices feed involved contacting people in Libya and recording their eyewitness accounts.
We were alarmed when we were met with live ammunition in the street.
Their stories were difficult to hear.
They killed a woman who were outside her doorsteps screaming for her son. She wanted him to come home. They shot her down.
And we couldn't do anything but listen. That last message was left on a Google Voice account by my husband's cousin, Usama. Like me, my husband Abdullah is the child of a dissident, and out of fear of endangering family back home, had never spoken to many of his relatives, including Usama. Now, suddenly, a connection, a deep one.
If we could get our hands on weapons, Abdullah, I swear to God we will get rid of this dog. You're my uncle's son. I have never laid eyes on you. This is the first time I ever spoken to you. I swear to God, Abdullah, I swear to God, since I was a little kid, I dreamed that I would be able to talk to you. I used to be afraid to even have thoughts about talking to you.
The February 17th revolution brought people together in ways we couldn't imagine. When the situation was desperate, we used the internet and social media to get information out. But ultimately, we used it the way people do every day, to connect. I'm finally in Tripoli, on my way to meet one of my regular contacts during the revolution, Hisham Bouhajar, who participated in last year's protests. Here's how he sounded then.
We saw the cars coming with a lot of soldiers. They started shooting immediately. I saw two people were shot, one of them in the head, was 2 meters away from me. I saw even one machine gun that's mounted over a truck, which used to fight aircraft. That was used against the demonstrators.
Our connection was made through my father, who Hisham had contacted shortly before the uprising began.
I told him, listen, in a few days we will start something, maybe it will end up in a big revolution, and can you help? We were thinking about a peaceful demonstration, and we will get the security by the media coverage, because if the media sees who we are, Gaddafi cannot hurt us. That's what we thought at that time.
How did you know in advance of February 17th to expect something?
Through Facebook. I saw a lot of talking. People were outspoken, and the talk was louder and louder. I was confident something is going to happen.
Hisham never used his real name with me. He knew the regime was watching, so he sent videos and updates with fake Facebook and Skype accounts.
If you know a little bit about the communication equipment and the surveillance in Libya, you can work safely. Through our own satellite station, you can send and receive information to the internet. We don't open it all the time. You know how I used to do it. I only open like for 1 hour, do my work, and then shut it down.
Hisham was able to protect his communications, but not himself. On February 25th, he helped organize a peaceful demonstration after Friday prayer. He decided to talk to the police outside the mosque first.
I'm talking to the police in a nice, soft voice, and their reaction was astonishing. They took the shotgun and immediately they shot at me. I was really shocked.
I called you right after you got shot. You were apologizing to me, saying, Sara, I'm sorry, I can't really talk right now, I just got shot, but I'll call you later.
Yeah, that was also a hard day.
I remember hanging up with you and saying, I can't believe he's apologizing to me. He just got shot.
Yeah, I thought part of our war against Gaddafi was a media war. So I thought I'm doing my job. And it got to the point where I can't do it anymore because I was shot.
Hisham fled the scene with 11 bullets in his leg, but he couldn't risk a trip to the hospital.
Because if they see the wounds, of course they will arrest me, and most probably they will kill me. Yeah? And this is what happened to a lot of people.
Hisham needed surgery, so he hopped the last commercial flight out of Tripoli, ending up in Belgium. That's when I finally learned who he was. Not a stranger, practically an uncle. He sent me a photo.
It was a picture of you in Seattle in probably 1985 at a picnic, and you were holding me, and I was 1 or 2 years old. And that's when I first knew who you were.
Oh, you're the daughter of my friend, and I feel like you're my family. And I thought, okay, I should give you some confidence of knowing who I am.
Surgeons were only able to remove some of the bullets in his leg, and Hisham anxiously returned to Libya. He says he couldn't stand by and watch as the regime's propaganda machine tried to convince the world that nothing was happening in Tripoli.
We had to do something to show that Tripoli was against Gaddafi, to use the media like Gaddafi is using it.
Early one morning, Hisham and nearly 3 dozen others gathered at a well-known landmark in Tripoli. They blocked the streets with their cars, covered their faces, and filmed themselves holding up anti-government banners, while a spokesperson read a statement.
We said that Tripoli is not with Gaddafi, and we are not afraid of you. Okay, you are much powerful now, but you have to understand Tripoli will be like a burning stone under your feet.
Hisham says videos like that one broke the fear barrier, and protesters around the city began making symbolic gestures to show the world and one another that they were still around.
Symbolic things like, okay, the falling flag. You take a flag, dip it in water, put it in the freezer, and then at night we put it over a bridge. When the ice melts, and the flag drops immediately.
So that there's nobody there when the flag actually falls.
Of course, if they see you doing the flag, you're gone. Eh? Balloons, hot air balloons also with the flag. It was distracting for the government so much. I saw one time when the balloon came with the flag, maybe 1,000 bullets went to that balloon, I mean, just to try to get it down. For us, it was an energizing thing to do.
Eventually, Hisham and many others took up arms, and along with NATO, defeated the regime. He also got shot in the legs a few more times. Today, Hisham has returned to a mostly civilian life, running his carpet and restaurant businesses. And as more exiles return to Libya, Hisham continues to make connections, reuniting with old friends.
We have a meeting that we do every Wednesday in the restaurant. Every time we bring somebody, it's usually I didn't see for 25 years, 30 years. And it's really amazing, really amazing. It's totally different feeling. Yeah?
Covering the revolution on social media brought me together with someone from my past. For Ahmed Adarat, monitoring the revolution on social media led him to a complete stranger who would change his life.
I grew up in a Libyan exile community in Lexington, Kentucky. And all the people that I was around, they're all passionate about returning home to a free Libya. That passion really rubbed off on me.
I've known Ahmed all my life. I also happened to be married to his cousin. In 2009, Ahmed and my husband Abdullah founded Enough Gaddafi, a group of second-generation Libyan exiles trying to draw attention to the atrocities of the Gaddafi regime.
Gaddafi and his son Saif were kind of starting to get a little comfortable with the West. Saif even tried to reach out to young Libyan Americans such as myself to basically jump on his bandwagon. You know, hey, come on this trip. Basically trying to buy them.
I'm Rahman Jibani. I was one of those that was sucked up in the bribes they had for us, who actually were invited out for free to come visit Libya for the summer.
Rahma Jabani was raised in California and went to Libya on a regime-sponsored trip in 2010, after which her family decided to move there. A year later, she watched with anticipation as the Arab Spring began in Tunis and spread to Egypt. When Rahma started seeing rumblings calling for a Libyan Day of Rage, February 17th, she created an image in support of the event and posted it on Facebook.
I was like, yay, we're finally next in line. It's our turn now.
So this girl named Rahma, I saw her post this February 17th graphic that she made, you know, come out, protest. And then I found out she was in Tripoli, and I was like, what is she doing? So I messaged her, I was like, what are you doing right now? You're in Tripoli and you're doing stuff like this.
After that meeting on Facebook, they decided to stay in touch. And a few days later, Rahma, with her father and brother, joined an anti-government protest in Tripoli. She called Ahmed.
And she's all excited. Oh my God, we're protesting. There's like 300, 500 people here. That was the first time that she called me, the first time we actually spoke on the phone. I hung up and I was like, oh my God, this is freaking awesome.
And sooner or later, all I see is the SWAT team shooting. Everyone just disperses. And a guy comes to me and he's like, you run. So I just started running. And that's when I called Ahmed.
She's like, out of breath. She's like, oh my God, they started shooting. Oh my God.
As she was running away, Rahma let us record her for the Voices feed.
They just brought us up. We were about 300 people. And the cops came and they started shooting gunfires at us. So we're trying to get escape.
Rahma continued to give regular updates to Ahmed, to Feb 17 Voices, and to the international media.
Well, Rahma is a Libyan activist. She joins us now on the line from the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Rahma, thanks for speaking to Al Jazeera.
In the Green Square, there's been riots. There are sniper shooters on the rooftops ready to shoot anybody who does any suspicious movement.
So I just felt like, you know, I need to do something on my part. I had CNN, I had Al Jazeera International, I had BBC. They would literally call me all day. Later, we started hearing that people were getting taken in because they were calling news media.
At that time, I was like, man, this girl, she's got some guts, man. That was that first spark of attraction. She would give me regular updates as to what was going on. Every time she would hear the NATO strikes, she'd be like, yeah, I heard at least 10 or 20 strikes, one after another. But after that, these strikes started to become a regular thing. So it just started to become, hey, I'm checking up on you. And then it would turn into a regular conversation.
I was like, oh, who's this guy checking up on me and caring? And once in a while, he would call me sweetie and I would get like butterflies in my stomach. And I'm like, oh my God, he called me sweetie.
The conflict wore on for months and they grew closer every day. Rahma was careful, talking only in secret and swapping SIM cards in her cell phone. But Gaddafi forces confiscated her phone after seeing her use it to film a long line for gasoline, a common sight those days because of the fuel shortages. She thought she was safe. Just the week before, water had damaged her old phone, and her new one had no contact numbers and no incriminating messages. But she didn't know that one of her cousins, with her face covered, had taken a picture of herself in front of the revolutionary flag using Rahma's phone. When the soldiers saw the photo, they pointed a Kalashnikov rifle at Rahma and her 14-year-old sister, all the way to the detainment center.
The whole time I was like panicking. I looked at my sister and she's wearing the same exact jacket as the girl in the picture. So I told my sister, I was like, oh, I'm really cold, give me your jacket. And I was holding her hand tight and I told her, I love you. And we just started praying.
After hours of questioning, Rahma was able to convince her interrogators that she wasn't the girl in the picture. She and her sister were released, but her family decided it was time to leave. They eventually made their way to the eastern Libyan city of Benghazi, which Gaddafi forces had lost early on in the uprising. In the months that followed, Gaddafi was killed, and Ahmed went to Libya for the first time in his life.
And I had like this out-of-body experience. I couldn't believe it. I was looking around. I was like, I'm in Libya. I'm in Libya right now. It was like a dream.
July 1st, 2012, we got married.
July 1st, we had our wedding ceremony.
What the hell are you guys going to talk about now? Your courtship happened during a revolution. A revolution that nobody imagined would ever actually happen in Libya. I mean, you're talking about groceries now? Like, life's going to seem so boring.
I'm going to call him and be like, yeah, there was like 5 airstrikes. You know, just to heat things up.
Ahmed and Rahma's wedding also marked a symbolic end to exile for many of the guests, who traveled from everywhere to attend. The party was epic, but an even bigger celebration was coming. It's election day in Libya.
I'm standing in the middle of Martyr Square, formerly Green Square. That honking that you're hearing is the melody of a chant that people here have been
singing during the revolution, and it goes, "Arfa rasak fog, anta ribi hur," and that means, raise your head up, you're a free Libyan. And so all over the city today, people have been honking that melody as part of the celebration and the festivities.
Now for me, this story isn't about media anymore. It's not about people connecting online, on Facebook or on Twitter. It started there, but it ends here, with people connecting to their homeland. Specifically my dad, who after more than 30 years in exile, was finally able to return to Libya last year. I've barely been able to see him during this trip, because since November, he's been serving as the country's Minister of Higher Education. But Election Day is a national holiday, so we're sharing a rare moment together. He's taking me to see his old elementary school.
Which was the only elementary school in this part of the city.
Did you guys do your homework on stone tablets?
No, actually it was much more advanced then than now. We had much better classrooms and we even had school buses. We don't have any of that now. And there used to be a church here in this corner of the school. And a post office on this corner. And that's the school.
How do you still remember where everything is? It's been more than 3 decades.
Don't forget these things.
Today's election marks the first time since 1965 that Libyans have been able to vote. And on this day, 3 generations of my family went together to see democracy in action. My grandfather says he's been waiting for this day his whole life, that he finally feels pride for his country. And my normally cranky grandmother, I've never seen her as happy as when she talks about voting today. And my aunt snapping her photo as she dropped the ballot into the box.
So I see my mom coming out of the area right now. She's waving her ink-stained finger. How was it?
I felt I did something right for my first time in this place here. So I'm so excited. And I feel I want to jump and do things like a little girl. So excited. So happy. I want to cry too.
Okay, and now my dad just came out. He's wiping his finger. So how was it?
That's good. These are very special times for Libya and Libyans, of course, to be able to vote for the first time after so many years. People paid very high price for this moment.
I can feel the people who are not with us now. That's painful. And I wish they're with us, or they can see or they can feel what they start. And inshallah, we're gonna be fine.
The Election Day celebrations went on into the early morning. And this month, Libya saw its first peaceful transition of power when the National Transitional Council passed the baton to the newly elected General Assembly. Libya is collectively healing from months of war and decades of oppression. Institutions are being built from scratch. A phrase I frequently hear is Libya hurra, or Libya is free, often just used to justify doing whatever you want. And most Libyans here have no real memory of what freedom is. But maybe, as my father said about his old school, you don't forget these things. For On the Media, I'm Sara Abdirahman.
Oh, wow, that's really sad.
It's very different there today.
Sarah's joining us now. Yeah, 2 different governments at war with each other, and amid the chaos, a perfect haven for ISIS to take up residence. Your father's in the government. He's not in the country at the moment. He's in the parliament.
After his time working in the first transitional government as higher education minister, he went back to the University of Tripoli, where he actually used to teach in the 70s, and he started teaching again, and then also on the side trying to stay involved with politics as much as he could, and is currently in 1 of the 2 governments. I will say one thing about the whole Libya experience that I think might be interesting. I read news with so much more skepticism now than I ever did before, and that's because I
so many times throughout the revolution and in the aftermath, saw one thing and read a completely different thing. And from, you know, legitimate news sources, I don't think anybody's lying, but saw explanations for things that didn't really track, didn't really make sense when you understand on a more personal level what's happening. It's so easy to label things as extreme this or militant that or Islamist this or secular that. There's just so much gray area. I'm like, who is this in my like real understanding of this? I'm not exactly sure that this matches up with what I would call this.
Yeah.
So it's really, you want to talk about fog of war. I mean, Libya is, for as dry of a place it is very foggy.
Now, your father isn't there now. You talk to him sometimes. You just had a baby. Congratulations.
And actually, going back to that piece, Ahmed and Rahma, the couple that I mentioned, just had their second baby.
Really?
Yeah. They have two boys now. So that stuck.
When you talk to your father, does he seem sad? Does he talk about what's going on in Libya?
I think the few times that we've been able to get together in person over the past couple of years, he's so uninterested in talking anything to do with Libya. I mean, that's really like their lives right now. They're very immersed in it. So I think he's just so relieved to talk about mundane things like movies or whatever else is going on with us.
Suleiman the Magnificent.
Yeah, or his two new grandkids, one from me and one from my brother. Yeah, I think he's just tired. But I mean, I'm sure he's been tired for the past 30 plus years. My dad certainly hasn't given up yet.
Sarah, we've never done an exit interview on the air before, and I don't really want to do one now. I just want to say that the work you've done here and just your general serene presence has done a huge amount for us, and we're going to miss you so much.
For the record, Brooke's trying to get me to cry. I'm going to miss you guys.
Do you have any idea what you're going to do next? Or is Suleiman absorbing all of your time?
He's pretty much full time right now. Baby! He looks shocked from the control room. I do think being a producer is really good training for being a mom, because it's just constant troubleshooting and making things work. And that's what you do as a parent. So,
so true.
And having so many great moms that I work with.
Well, we love you.
I love you guys too. Thank you so much, Brooke. And Bob.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Kasia Mihailovich, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Jesse Brenneman, and our show was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Joe Plord. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.